All right. Well, hey, thanks for checking in for another episode of Triple Play. Don't forget to like and subscribe, and don't forget to support those that support us, like Brooks Bible College. If you have not already heard about Brooks Bible College, they're an incredible Bible college here in the Midwest, and we highly recommend them. You may not know this, but if you go into ministry, most people come out with 50 to 100 grand worth of debt because they go to some liberal arts college and they got to go do all this other stuff. Brooks Bible College, you're going to come out with about 20 or less. And on top of that, if you even come out with any, but the other thing is you're going to have a usable degree that was focused on just being a Bible. Okay. And if that ain't enough, just remember this, the average church size is about 75 people. Going to be hard to pastor a church of 75 to 100 people if you've got a whole lot of debt. And if you're going into missions, how are you going to do it? So these are all questions they're relevant questions. So check out Brooks Bible College. I highly recommend them. We love everybody there. I can't brag about them enough. And so check them out. That said, we are excited for our guest today. Today, we have Amy Post. Amy is an author, an advocate, and podcaster, and the list continues to grow, right?
Yes, it does.
So, and she has a new book out called Out of the Gray. It's coming out, I guess. It's right now you can pre-order it. But it's about your personal story with you and your daughter. I don't want to give too much away, but it is a pleasure to have you here today. And I want to hear a little bit about, you know, where you came from, where you grew up in St. Louis, and then we'll kind of get into the basis of your book maybe a little bit.
Yeah, so. Absolutely, Josh. Thank you so much. It's a complete pleasure to be here. And I just, this is new for me, doing podcasts and having my own podcast. And, you know, the story is just such an interesting story. So, yeah, and I didn't grow up in St. Louis. So anybody who would ever ask me, where did you go to high school? I would just say, well, you probably don't know. So I grew up in Springfield, Missouri, right outside of Branson.
Okay.
And spent most of my life there. Moved to Colorado, lived there for a while, lived in Florida for a while, and then to St. Louis. So that's kind of where, you know.
Around a little bit, around and then back, hey? Kind of?
Yeah, finished up my college here in St. Louis. I went to business school in Vienna, Austria, and got my degree in communications and business, and really just stayed here. I love the Midwest. It's just, I love the seasons, you know, so, yeah.
Now, did you meet your husband in college or did you meet him afterwards?
I met him after. So he knew me when we lived in Springfield together, but I did not know him. So when we tell the story, it's pretty amusing. But we met after I moved to St. Louis. He had already been here for several years. We met at the gym. It's one of those things. I was going through very hard breakup. I had dated someone for 6 or 7 years. We were engaged, broke everything off. And I had a girlfriend that told me you need to go at 5 p.m. I was like, I don't go at 5 p.m. I go at 5 a.m. So I did. And I met him. And that was kind of all she wrote. So we've been together almost 17 years. We have two kids. My daughter Madison is 13. My son is 16. They both go to Christian schools and very active, super busy. So, but very grateful. And, you know, our story starts back almost 10 years ago.
Wow. That's amazing. That's really, really cool. So you obviously had a career going. What were you doing prior to like the event that we're going to be talking about? What were you doing at this time when you first got married, and what was your kind of your career path?
Yeah, I've done medical sales.
Okay.
Medical and aesthetic medical sales for my entire career. Well, I started out in veterinary sales and I traveled the nation. Great, great job. Love the medical industry. And then just kind of transitioned into aesthetics, was that in that for 14 years, and now I'm in medical sales.
So you're in medical, so you're in the world of medicine to some degree.
Yes.
So this is, so when we get into talking about your daughter and you, this is not an unknown territory to some degree, it's just a different area of it.
Yeah, different area for sure.
Yeah. So what, walk me through, what kind of happens that gets you to writing this book? Obviously the experience, what kind of... I know a little bit from the reading the intro, a little bit of what you put out on Amazon, but tell us.
Yeah, it's an interesting story. And I can only say that God has taken me here. It has been one of the most wild adventures I've ever been on in my entire life, but I can say I'm more happy. I'm happier than I've ever been. And God really kind of found me in an unusual place about a year and a half ago. It was the fall of 2022. I was suicidal, had three attempts, almost divorced. I was absolutely self-destructing. And I dropped my daughter off at school one morning, and my car just sort of drove itself right up and around and parked in Fellowship Church parking lot. And I just cried. I went in, talked to the pastors, sat inside for about 3 hours and just cried. And it had been a situation where the months leading up to that, I had had a lot of just memories of the past. At that point, it was past 8.5 years of the situations with my daughter, and I was reliving everything over again. I couldn't sleep. I couldn't eat. I couldn't function. I didn't know what was happening to me. And in that parking lot and then walking into the church, I was realizing that God was just taking me somewhere. It was on His timing. I didn't know what it was, and I was absolutely terrified. And I think I was about as terrified as when the story starts almost 10 years ago and what we went through. So God took me through an incredible journey of just finding myself and giving me the ability to look back through those last 9 years with different lenses, different perspectives, looking at everything that I had been through. And I honestly, I know without a shadow of a doubt, I mean, God saved me. God saved me from myself, saved me from complete destruction and probably suicide. Mm. It's something that I think it needs to be talked about. I don't think we recognize it as much. I don't look like I would be suicidal. I don't know what that looks like, but I think we sort of judge those types of things. So that was really that aha moment. And I knew that God wanted me to write a book about what I had been through with my daughter over the past 9 years.
So the outside world, before you go into the church, if the outside world looked in, you would look like you were an everyday American, probably, right? Successful.
Absolutely. Top of my...
Driving a good vehicle, yeah. Good house.
Yeah, great house.
Married. Looked like on the outside that it was probably good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, everything looked fine because I know how to do that. It's just what I've been programmed and programming myself to do for a very long time. Nobody would have ever known that was going, the storm was going on inside of me. I was at the top of my company, won President's Club that year, Rookie of the Year, every award that you could win. I was making more money than I'd ever made in my entire career, and I was miserable.
Wow.
Miserable.
In your marriage, you said you were on the brink of divorce. I imagine it had to be friction behind the scenes, but there was this unsettledness. Even though you're being successful on the outside, everything else is just...
Everything else was falling apart.
Wow.
It was falling apart. Yeah. And so it's an interesting story, but I can say God intervened in some of the ways that I could have never imagined in my life. I didn't, as I kind of tell the story, I didn't know God as well. There was a lot of loneliness, and the relationship I have with God now is absolutely the most amazing relationship I could have ever imagined. I don't think I could have even written it any better.
And so it started 10 years earlier, though. There was this buildup with your daughter. What your daughter was diagnosed with something, right? What was it?
Yeah. So I was supposed to leave on a sales meeting. Actually, I was in aesthetics, and I was supposed to fly to California one early morning. Did not get to take that trip. So if you rewind it about 3 days, 4 days, her daycare gave us a call. And says she's just not feeling well. She sat down on the playground and she just doesn't want to play. And I instinctively knew that something was really wrong. Not that she was just sitting down. I just knew something was wrong.
Did you see any signs beforehand?
We did.
Okay. So there were some signs that you'd been seeing, and this kind of culminated when that happened to say, okay, those signs are leading somewhere.
Yeah, she had had sporadic temperatures for 6 months, and we had gone to her pediatrician, called every week. I was in the office. They assured us that nothing was wrong. They didn't want to get a second opinion, didn't want to go any further, didn't want to do anything. And I knew that there was something going on. But the moment we were told that she was not playing and sat down on the playground, I knew immediately that something was wrong. And she was spiking temperatures and just not feeling well for the next couple of days. And on that third day, she spiked about 104 temperature and was just bellowing over in pain. And she was three. So very, very little, wasn't really able to tell us what was going on. I thought maybe it was appendicitis.
Sure.
You know, I had to have my appendix removed when I was three. They almost burst. So, you know, our first thoughts were, you know, something just relatively, you know, expected for that. And my husband took her into a nearby hospital. It wasn't one of the children's hospital, but he woke me up at 5 a.m. and said, "We have to go to the hospital." And I said, "Why?" And he said, "Well, I didn't wake you up at 3:30 when I received the phone calls, but we have to go immediately." And I had had a really bad stomach ache the night before. And I thought maybe my daughter and I, you know, just something was going on, maybe stomach flu. We took her into Children's Hospital. And after, you know, hours, it probably was 6-7 hours, we were told that she had malignant liver cancer. And not only that, that she was going to be, you know, admitted to the hospital right then and there. Chemotherapy would start that week, blood infusions. And the physician was just white as a sheet and said, "I'm so sorry. I'm so very sorry to have to tell you this. I couldn't imagine worse news." And from that moment, we were whisked into the system. And that was kind of our beginning of our journey.
So she's at a children's hospital. She's got liver, a very specific liver cancer. And according to your book, this cancer was going to require her to battle it not once, but three times. Is it? Did I understand that right?
Yes. Yes. So when we were admitted, they didn't know everything, just that she was going to have a liver transplant. It was malignant stage 4 liver cancer. It was hepatoblastoma of the liver, which anybody out there who has, you know, had anybody with the hepatoblastomas, and about a week or two later, we were told that she had a rare genetic cancer gene, and that genetic gene would cause 2 additional cancers within her life. It would cause colon cancer and then thyroid cancer. And they were very specific.
That's very interesting. They can specifically say that. Yeah.
They can specifically target them, but it's such a rare gene. It's not studied. So it was just, there wasn't a lot of information given.
Did they know when and what ages she would have to deal with those things? Did they have that pinpointed? Like it'll be between this age and that age for this part?
They did. The first hepatoblastoma is actually between ages 3 and 4. And it was bingo right a few months before she was 4. And the next cancer, which will be colon cancer, is between ages 13 and 17. And she is just now 13, almost 14. So we are in that second cancer. The third will be thyroid, and that's at age 46 or 47. And so very, very specific.
But at least they know, and that way she can be monitored highly during that time period and get it addressed before it becomes an issue, right? So
Yeah, she can.
Kind of a curse and a blessing in a way.
Yeah, looking back now, absolutely.
But at that time, I can't imagine as a parent, 3-year-old, I've got 6 kids, that would rock my world very, very much. Are you at this time when all this is going on, are you obviously, I know that you faith played a big turn in what happened a couple years ago, but at this time, where are you at with your faith? Where are things at? Yeah. Is it even there? Or is it just like, I'm just playing church? Or is it like, I'm not even going to church?
Yeah, you know, my husband and I, we were going to church. You know, we were very involved. I told you before the interview, I was, you know, volunteering, you know, with the kiddos in the nursery, and we really enjoyed it. Found a great church that we loved. I didn't know God as well as I wanted to. I talked about this in the book, but I had searched for God for many, many years. When I was young and growing up, we would bounce around. There would always be something about the church that, you know, wasn't acceptable. And so we would bounce to a different church. And I really just wanted to be involved. That was my number one thing. I just wanted to be involved and feel like I was a part of the church. And my husband and I were a part of the church, but I think I had always just been searching for something that I didn't know what I was searching for. I was searching for this purpose and this gift that I didn't know what it was. I didn't know what it looked like. Things were very confusing. I was just confused about who God was and how God was supposed to work in my life, because I really hadn't been shown that.
You weren't discipled. Nobody discipled you and walked you through and said, this is what the Christian walk is like.
Yeah.
You know, you kind of knew God, knew you needed him. You accepted the fact that you need to be saved. But like many people, that's kind of where it ends. You hear these sermons on Sunday and often they're good. They motivate you sometimes, or they make you do self-reflection. But I mean, honestly, that sounds like a lot of Americans probably.
Yeah. Yeah. So just very lost, I think, during that time. And then when my daughter was diagnosed, it was just a feeling of terror, sheer terror, fear, what you've been told, the unknown. I didn't have a playbook. I remember begging God every single day for a playbook. Just tell me what I need. Tell me what's going to happen. And I can follow the rules. I can follow the steps very well. And, you know, come to find out, I'm so thankful I never had a playbook, because I wouldn't be sitting here today if I didn't have a playbook. I wouldn't have needed God in my life so much, so drastically, so begging every single day for God to just show up. And I wouldn't have advocated for myself or my daughter if I would have been given some sort of playbook that gave me, you know, page by page of what was going to happen.
Wow. And so I know part of this is advocacy. When I read your book, and obviously it's in the title too, right? You're an advocate, a memoir of advocacy and hope. How does the advocacy kind of come into play? Because you hear something like that, you're in the medical industry, but my guess is you start to find out that it's built on numbers and not on individuals. And that the pharmaceutical medical community is built around profit and not necessarily around treatment. And so what were some of the things that you had that started kind of bringing that you kind of had to go through? Obviously, I don't want to give away the whole book. We could, I'm sure we could get really deep into some of the things that the book will explain, but just at a surface level, what are some of the things that you kind of started first discovering that led to this idea that, man, there's no advocate in this industry right now, or for people like my daughter?
Yeah. So, you know, I think first and foremost, it was, I think, the way that doctors appear. You know, there's not a lot of humility. You don't feel God in a hospital very often. It feels as though you enter those doors and it's almost as if you have been locked out of heaven and almost locked out. Every time, you know, I turned around, the hospital was growing and growing. And I discuss it in the book. I mean, the hospital, when we were there, I mean, it was doubling in size. It's tripled, if not quadrupled, you know, almost 10 years later. A children's hospital. That's not okay. That is not right. And I think, you know, as much as I would look at it, everything was wrong, from the food. The food that's served. I found out that there was great food that was served and the hospital canceled that contract. So, you know, all there seemed to be was, you know, pizza and fried foods and processed foods and things that absolutely are not appropriate for the doctors, the nurses, the parents, or the patients.
And certainly not a peak performance, right?
Absolutely. And you're wanting these children to get better. So, you know, advocating, and I go into it in the book, and it's pretty comical. I'm surprised I didn't get thrown out of that hospital. And, you know, we had a physician, I think he was a fellow at that point, going through, you know, some different trainings. I don't exactly know what his job was. He was lurking around in our room one night, felt completely uncomfortable. And I remember the next day, my family, you know, had come to see us and asking, you know, me to stop causing trouble, just stop causing problems. You know, they're not going to treat Madison if you just keep causing problems. And I remember telling one of the nurses, you know, he's not allowed in our room ever again. And they're like, well, he's coming back. He'll come back every single day. That's his job. And I really just had to stand my ground. I ended up getting the director involved, and I didn't want to take the brash approach that I did, but I knew that I had to. And she finally admitted to me that there were several families that had complained about this individual. But yet that individual was still allowed to be in these children's rooms, lurk around, and make the hair on the back of my neck stand up. They removed him from the floor, and they removed him from all floors within that hospital. We had other things that came up in regards to the amount of drugs that they give you, the amount of painkillers they give these little kids and the dosages of them. Crazy amounts. And so I called numerous meetings with the directors to just figure it out. So we went through all these different stages and I spent most of my time just researching.
I know. And there's an action documentary out right now on the life of those people who were pushing those painkillers. I mean, basically, we were given heroin disguised as painkiller.
Yeah. And my daughter didn't need painkillers. They were offering them and we would ask her and she wasn't in pain. They would have 6 painkillers up on the board that they were just giving her. So I had a notebook and I would write everything down and I was sleep deprived. What I forgot to tell you is we were admitted on that first day and we didn't get out. We got out 4 weeks later for the very first time that we were able to stagger out of that hospital. We would get to go home for 24 to 48 hours and we would come back for another 4 weeks. It was like a jail sentence, just every time we turned around. And every time we turned around again, when we were readmitted, she would be well again and she would get immediately sick. And I remember looking, we'd be quarantined to our room and nobody was allowed in except the physicians and the nurses. Yet they didn't wear gloves, masks. They weren't suited up. They just brought the germs in and out of our room. And I remember calling a meeting. I'm not the smartest tool in the shed, but I do know that it just seems as though there are viruses and things running rampant around with these kids. There are drugs given that completely deplete and kill the immune system. She was, you know, I think at one point she was already given chemotherapy, and that was just killing her body, killing all the good and the bad cells. Just these kids didn't stand a chance. And it was, you know, I changed protocols, you know, they suited up the next time we were in. I had to tell them, you know, we'll get the attorneys involved. It was absolutely just something I didn't understand.
You would have thought common sense, especially with like chemotherapy, you know, I you know, masks became more popular during COVID, but even prior to that, you would have thought hand sanitizer, washing the hands a lot. You know, just when you're around kids, I have a dad of 6. I mean, it was funny. Prior to COVID, everybody called us germophobes. And then after COVID, because we didn't want to go to the extremes that they all of a sudden went to, we were like, you know, like the outsiders. And I'm like, wait, what? Just a couple months ago, you were calling me a germaphobe because we use sanitizer with all of our kids. We just normal germ, bacteria, wiping things down. That was just our normal. Mm-hmm. And now you're freaking out about that, plus all this other stuff. And you've taken it to a whole nother level past us because of something you don't understand. And I just find it very, when you hear that, it's so interesting how society it flipped on a dime on that. But you're absolutely right. You go in a lot of these places, and especially prior to 2020, they didn't do it. And then afterwards, they were so extreme, it was ridiculous on the other end. You know, like, find balance.
Right, right.
You know, the common sense. You need to have clean hands. Mm-hmm. You can be around kids, especially if they have had their whole immune system rocked through chemotherapy. Absolutely. You need to be cautious of that, sterile as much as possible, because that really drops that immune system if there's any at all.
Oh, so. Absolutely. And they couldn't fight off anything. It was just, it was so interesting. The things that we found out seemed to be quite intentional, and intentional, not in a good way. And I think that that's really where a lot of my research started coming into is, I don't want to go the traditional route. I don't think this is the route for us. We need to get out of here. And, you know, why 6 rounds of chemo? I mean, I watched my daughter almost completely die. If the chemotherapy doesn't kill you, it will kill everything within you. So you will never be able to fight anything off after that. And you will be continually sick with all the drugs that they give you. And it was quite interesting because I lost my job during this, and I talk about it in great length in the book. Absolutely just down and out. Things couldn't have gotten any worse. But when I thought that they couldn't get any worse, they kept getting worse. And I remember receiving a phone call stating that, let me back it up. We were told that Madison would die without 6 rounds of chemotherapy. The doctor stood in our doorway and said, she will die without 6 rounds. And I said, you know, I just need more data. I need to understand this more. They don't supply things to you. They still, I think to this day, are just very hesitant to supply parents with data, but yet we deserve to know and see that data. And after we were told that she would die without 6 rounds, I lost my job. So I lost my insurance. lost everything. And she was getting ready to come in for another round of chemotherapy. And they called and said, well, you know, we won't make you come in since you don't have insurance. You know, just call us when you have insurance. I about flipped a lid. The light bulb started going off. Things just started happening. You know, that's not okay. It's not normal. It's not what you think of somebody coming into the hospital and they're supposed to help you get better, supposed to feed you good food, supposed to watch out for these kiddos. And then all of a sudden, you know, we're told she'll die. But then, oh gosh, you don't have insurance. So can you be gone? Well, you know, just call us when you have insurance. There was no concern for her life. No concern for anything. So it's just a different part of the book that really kind of brings a different thread through the book.
Was your daughter feeling any of this? You know, did she recognize any of this during that time? Or were you able to really play cover to this information?
I told her everything. You know, she was 3 when she was diagnosed, and she started chemotherapy very quickly, I think the week of. And then she had a full liver transplant a month later. And so it was right before her fourth birthday. And so she did understand as much as I think she could.
Sure.
She hated it. She hated everything about it. She hated the situation, but she hated the doctors. They didn't talk to her. They talked at her. They talked over her, around her, at her. I mean, we're a research project. I mean, if anybody has been in the hospital with a sick child, or God forbid, you know, a child with a disease or cancer, we were, you know, rushed to the PICU so many times, I can't even count. She was under anesthesia 70 some times within the first year. It was just never ending. And they'll file in your room, you know, at 4:30 or 5 in the morning and just treat you like a research project. And you're not actually human. I think it's just so dehumanizing and so degrading. And I do understand that there is a level of kind of professionalism, and that they're where they have to kind of keep their mind because they are doctors and they can't get overly involved. But we had one nurse that my daughter just clung to, just loved her. She was just different. You could just tell she just lit up the room when she walked in, and she had a different aura about her. Just everything about her was different. She spoke to us and to Madison and was just different. And we found out that her sister was diagnosed with brain cancer and she passed away. And this nurse agreed that she was going to become a nurse to help people. And if it was the last thing she did, she would be a different kind of nurse and she would help people. It was just mind blowing. It just chills, you know, knowing that she just had that ability to know how to act and what to do, but she had walked in those shoes.
Do you think that was part of it? Is we got a lot of people who are just doing careers and they don't see their job anything outside of a paycheck.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, we really did. And it became much more apparent as that process went on. And as our looking outside of traditional medicine, wanting the hospital to agree kind of to look outside, maybe more functional, maybe that the body can heal itself, maybe healthy food and detoxing and really kind of a different lifestyle could be something that we could have a good conversation on.
Or at least have it as an option. You would think. Again, I'm just thinking, if your immunity system shut down, you've got a very hard disease, putting grease. I get trying to make sure the kids are having some comfort food. I get that a little bit. Mm-hmm. But as the only food, that just seems very, very counterintuitive. I mean, you want to put your body in, as an athlete, in peak condition, right? I mean, but I guess it goes back to when you think about what we just went through with COVID, right? The people that freaked out the most were the people who were overweight the most.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And they wanted a pill. They wanted a jab. They wanted it. Mm-hmm. They wanted something so that their body naturally didn't have to fight it. Mm-hmm. Because it takes work to put your body in a peak area. And we were talking about this earlier. You were mentioning how you drink 2 gallons of water a day. That's incredible. I drink a little over a gallon. And I mean, but you got to be intentional about it.
Yes.
You can't drink a lot of sugar, you know, that just adds the weight on. Okay. There takes discipline. I don't know about you, but I go to the gym pretty much every night. Mm-hmm. It's I go to the gym. I do a lot of stationary work at my office. So getting out to the gym allows me, even if it's for 30 or 40 minutes, I just want to go all out. When I do, I just go all out and get a good cardio in, get the blood flowing, and I feel better too. I always come out, if I'm battling a little bit of a cold, I go work out. Mm-hmm. I always feel so much better and feel like my body's now able to fight it. Versus, I mean, the lazy part of me, often when that happens, let's say I feel like a cold coming on, my internal instinct is, let's just go home and not work out today. Let's just grab, you know, get hop on the couch, grab a hot cup of hot chocolate, relax. Mm-hmm. You know,
absolutely.
Everything in me screams for that, but the other part of me goes, but Josh, you dummy, that sugar, that's not, you know, yes, you need rest, but you got to go and get your body going and get it in peak condition so it can fight what's going on. And you don't do that by being lazy. So all that said, it just, when I hear what you're saying, I'm thinking about that. And then, you know, and I'm thinking about, you know, I have friends and family in the nursing industry, and many of them are great. They really do love people, and there are good people in the industry. There are many who see it as a job. Mm-hmm. It's a catch 22. We got to get things done, but we also got to have a compassion like a Patch Adams. You know, you watch the movie Patch Adams and we all think that's great. But the truth is most of us don't go to a hospital. They have lots of show areas. They'll have a play area, but it's not, it's more than just having that. It's the touch. Mm-hmm. One of the things about Patch was he touched. Mm-hmm. It's the, you know, not talking down to the patient, talking with the patient, even if they're young. Yeah. Maybe they can't understand all the heavy language, but they certainly can understand, you know, like, hey, how you feeling today? Mm-hmm. What's going on in your life?
Yeah.
You know, how's
like that. It was so interesting. It was, how's she doing today? I'm like, she's laying right here. Why don't you ask her? I think they the doctors got more shoes thrown at them, anything that she could find to throw at them. She did. And you would think there was just emotionless, just that was a part that really infuriated me. But it then kind of fired this fuel that I didn't realize was there. And so it allowed me to just push even harder to get us out of there and figure out what is behind the curtains that we're just not seeing. And just every time I took a different, you know, took a different turn and, you know, pulled up the rug and pulled back the curtains, we'd find something different that just, it was so unsettling. And I hate to say that, you know, all of these kiddos, it's a tough situation. And then to also think about it, you know, there were lots of kids that didn't have families there with them. I mean, at night, I can still hear it in my head, these babies and these kids screaming and crying up and down the hallways, nobody there with them. The nurses couldn't all attend to all of these kiddos. It was just absolutely just frightening to see kind of what was happening in these children all by themselves.
Wow. And of course, you know, no blame to the parents, because you got to pay the insurance and got to keep working. Mm-hmm. We had a organization on here not too long ago, the Mighty Oaks Foundation, and we were talking about that, how they try to go in and supplement incomes and things like that, because often these moms and dads can't work for months on end when that kind of stuff happens, and they've got to stay glued.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
And it's tough. It's the mortgages still come. Mm-hmm. Electric bill still comes, even if your life is on pause for a moment, because the most important thing in your life has to be addressed. And so,
And I mean, my husband and I couldn't both be there. So, you know, he went back, took care of our son. They lived their life and we lived our life in the hospital. And it became our home. You know, it became more of a home than anything else. We were there for, you know, several years, and it just didn't seem like we were going to get out, you know, just trying to find that way to be able to get out. And like I said, we changed a lot of protocols. We changed a lot of things, but it just took that advocating for myself and standing up, but advocating for her and for the others of things that we didn't want passed on to the other patients, you know.
Did, when you said that your dad, your husband and son were kind of living their lives, and you're, and you, I want to fast forward, because obviously this is going on and this is leading to your, I'm going to call it faith crisis moment. Mm-hmm. One of the things you said was the marriage. Was that part of the marriage struggle too? Is that you guys now are living two individual lives?
It was.
Yours is wrapped around your daughter. His is wrapped around the son. Both important. Both have needs.
Yeah, it was. And my husband would try to come and bring dinners, you know, certain evenings. My son would come up. But it was tough. Right before she was diagnosed, we actually moved much further away from the children's hospital. And I remember telling my husband, what if something happens to one of the kids? We're not close to one of the hospitals. He looked at me like I was crazy. And I remember just going, I have no idea why I just said that. I have no idea. I think we have intuitions. I think as mothers, we certainly have just those types of things inside of us. I think maybe I always knew. I think I always knew I was cut out for something different as well. I just didn't know what it was. But I think one of the biggest things that I certainly wasn't prepared for was how to handle, you know, continuing to be in a marriage. I mean, we were told 90% of the couples get divorced and children die. And I just needed to realize that very quickly. And that was told to us less than 24 hours after, you know, we were there. And I used to say, you know, after my husband kind of dumped us off there.
90% divorced. And they just tell you that right up front.
Right up front.
You got a daughter with cancer. On top of that, you'll probably be divorced in a couple of years.
Yeah.
And wow. I mean, just
crazy. It's just, I felt that everything is kind of stacked against parents. Everything seemed to be stacked against us. I couldn't even breathe. I absolutely couldn't breathe. But I remember that morning, and it was really unusual. All of this is feeling like, you know, I was just in this tornado that I couldn't get out of, and finding out what had happened and that 90% of, you know, parents get divorced, and wondering, oh my gosh, I mean, why? Like, what is getting ready to happen to us? I had absolutely no idea. I remember walking across the hallway. There was a little coffee area. And I remember there was a gentleman standing there drinking some coffee. And I asked him, it was pretty funny. I talk about it in the book, but I was like, what are you in for? Like we were both in for some prison sentence. I hadn't slept. I was absolutely just terrified, sleep deprived. And he had told me that his son had been diagnosed with cancer when he was about 3, and they had been in the hospital for a long time. He had been in remission for several years, and they were back again, and he had brain cancer. And I remember just closing my eyes after he walked out of that room and just tears rolling down my cheeks. And I said, I have absolutely nothing to feel bad about. I have to find something every single day to be blessed about. I have to be blessed. I have to count my blessings every single day in here. We're not going to make it. But what that gentleman just told me, I can't even imagine. I just can't imagine the terror. And then I, you know, fast forward the movie, you know, 10 years, and, you know, we're kind of within that time frame of our second cancer. And I remember it was like it was yesterday meeting him. I can remember everything about him. I can remember that conversation like it was yesterday. So,
yeah, as I hear that, I just think to myself, you know, there's a real ministry opportunity in hospitals, and especially children's hospitals that's being missed right now. Mm-hmm. These people need churches to come in and just love on them, maybe provide some assistance. So, for all the training that they're given doctors and all, that was another thing I was just thinking about, was they do all this sensitivity training, but it just seems like it's more sensitive to the things that matter the least versus the most, which is the patient.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And as we went through the journey, it just, everything was so very apparent. And I don't know how many people really pay attention to those types of things or have the ability to kind of think outside the box, but it was terrifying. But then I really started thinking, how do these couples manage? Well, it sounds like they don't manage well, because 90% get divorced. And that was just laid on the doorstep for us. And that's what the rest of our life is. This what it's going to be? Like, my daughter, just all of a sudden, we had a great life. Kids were healthy. We played. We had a great house. We had great jobs. We did whatever we want. We went to the park each weekend. It just, life was wonderful before this happened. And then to realize now everything had kind of been just completely taken away from us. I had a stack of files from, you know, this woman, our liaison or, you know, mentor. I think the stack was literally 2 or 3 inches tall of what was going to happen. All the procedures, all the drugs, just it was daunting, absolutely daunting. But to your statement, there wasn't even barely any resources. I think I was given a couple of individuals' names that I could call because they started a foundation after their child passed away.
Yeah, that's what I often find. That's what the Mighty Hoaks are. Yeah.
And I thought, how is this supposed to help me? I'm just not connecting the dots. Like, I can't find God. I'm literally, I just could be in a puddle, you know, in the corner of that room, just crying my heart out. But there were a lot of things that I learned through that, you know, strength and just there is hope. You just have to really know that there is hope on the other side. There's light through that tunnel and there is purpose in the pain that we go through. There is absolutely 100% a purpose. You just need to find it and flip that switch and kind of try to look at things differently. But I do feel that, you know, the couples that go through these situations, it's terrifying. If you can't get on the same page and you can't empathize for each other and really kind of set aside, you know, what you're feeling or you're feeling and just really try to come together as a unity, it's almost impossible. And what I expected was for my husband to just put himself in my shoes and understand exactly what I was going through. Yet he was living his own life at home and his job and picking my, you know, son up from school. And
he was probably thinking in his head, you should be understanding what I'm going through because I'm having to run the family now on my own while you're taking care of our daughter and working the job because now we got more stress because you don't have a job.
Yeah.
You know, I can easily see how that would add stress and where having ministry and people in church come alongside you and be like, hey, it's okay. You know, let's help out. Could really help out, you know, just the situation. As I'm seeing, I'm just thinking somebody listening should start a ministry. But
yeah.
That said, the other thing I'm thinking of is when you're talking about advocacy is, again, I keep thinking your daughter is trying to do this. You're there fighting for her. Mm-hmm. But where's everybody else? You know, and as time has gone on, you know, we had a podcast just about a week ago or so where, you know, he was talking about how he has a concierge health physician now because the ones that you get through your insurance don't really solve the issues and don't get to the bottom of it. And I am finding more and more of my wealthier friends are getting out of the public health system because just like we said it probably would when we started opening it up and making it available to everybody, it's become a one size fits all. And how that's very tough because everybody has uniqueness to it. And for him, it was a gluten allergy, but he had to go through a year or so of miserably almost dying several times, not being able to breathe, adding over 100 pounds to his body to get to the bottom of what was causing it. I mean, at one point they thought it was because of a cat allergy and he does have a cat allergy, but it wasn't cat allergy causing all this problem. And so I just think of all that going on in today's world and how easy it is to get lost in the numbers, lost in the system, because that's what it's become, a system. And as a young person, especially your daughter, I mean, it's tough on you. We're talking about the battle you're fighting. Mm-hmm. But your daughter looking up and going, I'm more than a number.
Mm-hmm.
I'm more than a number here.
Yeah, absolutely. And just to go back even to the pharmaceutical drugs, I mean, I had to say, she's not going to take those. She's not in pain. Ask her if she's in pain. And we would push back, but I would have to check them all. They made numerous mistakes. I kept that notebook for the longest time and just going back, okay, when did she have this? They would try to put things on the board. And it was just, you know, cross-referencing, trying to, you know, make heads or tails out of what was going on. But I was really surprised at the mistakes that they made. And I get it. Mistakes can happen.
Sure.
But, you know, she had even an allergy band on her ankle and her wrist. She's highly allergic to morphine. And she was given morphine twice.
Wow.
She was in there. And I watched her almost die. And it's just, and they almost gave it to her a third time and I caught it. And so I think anybody who's not in there advocating for someone, I don't care if it's a child or a family member or a friend, they need you.
If she died from the morphine, they probably wouldn't have admitted it, would they?
Right. Mm-mm.
They probably would have said died from natural causes.
Yeah. Yeah. And we had a situation where she had a liver biopsy and they nicked her liver and it was their fault and no responsibility taken. We went through another entire year that was absolutely terrifying. Her since she received a liver, the first one was from a pediatric liver, which she unfortunately didn't receive because her levels were elevated moments before she was supposed to get that surgery. She ended up getting an adult liver, and they portioned it. There's only one bile duct in that portion of the liver. There are two bile ducts in a full liver. She only had one. So that liver biopsy caved that liver, that bile duct in. And of course, scar tissue forms very, very quickly. And we were told right off the bat, very beginning, you know, she'll have to have another liver transplant. I'm really sorry. No responsibility taken. I mean, you just, I hope people will grab the book and read it. If you don't, if you can't imagine the twists and turns that are going to be taken, and you think that your life is really bad right now, just grab that book and read it, and you will say, you know, prayers for every blessing that you have, and you will find something to be blessed if you don't have blessings. And it was just, it was wild. But your question too about the families and what happens to them, I think is the hardest part. And it's kind of my advocating now is to prepare people for what they're going to go through in life and what, you know, life's challenges are going to set on your doorstep, because it's not if it will happen, it's when, and how will we be prepared and how will we kind of step up? And the relationship portion is a huge portion of it, because I couldn't understand then the 90-10 rule. I can understand it oh too well now.
Yeah, I'd even say the other thing, when you said it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when, mm-hmm. with the amount of playing with food and other things, we've seen a huge spike, cancers and other sicknesses that people are taking in, whether it be the dyes, whether it be hormones, whether it be altercations to a wheat. I mean, you go, you know, like Kevin, I mean, you know, wheat over in other countries doesn't have gluten.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. There are lots of medications. I was listening to a podcast the other day. There are lots of medications that are illegal in the rest of the world, but they're legal in the United States. And so they sell them here and make their millions here. Mm-hmm. And we don't ask the question, why is it illegal over there and legal here? Right. Why is German pharmaceutical companies making their most profitable, you know, thing here in the United States? Not saying that it's that in of itself is a bad, but asking the question as to why. Mm-hmm. One of the things I've kind of learned the older I get is just to ask, where's the money?
Yeah.
Because if you find the trail of money, mm-hmm. you'll find the incentive, and then you just got to work your way back. Mm-hmm. You know, whether it be politics, whether it be pharmaceuticals, whether it be the healthcare, any industry. Almost always, inevitably, the driver is going to be the finances, the money. So finding where that is, mm-hmm. and working backwards helps me to figure out how to get the best service, how to get the best care out of it. And so
absolutely. And I would ask through the process, you know, what is your exit strategy for mm-hmm. her? And they would look at me as if I was crazy. Absolutely crazy. Like, what is the exit strategy for the drugs? Like, what is the exit strategy? But what does that look like? Well, that was nowhere in the 3-4 inches of the, you know, booklet that they gave me. It just, you open these things and it's just like doom and gloom of what's going to happen. There's no like positivity. So I think I called 4 meetings with the heads of all the departments. And one of the meetings was specifically to speak about exit strategy and with the drugs and the contraindications of all the drugs. And they sat in front of me and said, there's no contraindications with any of the drugs that she's using. That's probably the craziest thing I've ever heard in my entire life. And hopefully people that don't have any idea what I'm barely talking about probably hopefully think that that's the craziest thing they had ever heard too, because every drug has some sort of effect and another drug is going to have an effect on that effect. And they just, it's as if this giant boulder just can never be stopped because of all of the adverse effects and things that are and contraindications of these drugs. And so when I
think about that, the media, I just think of superstars have died.
Yeah.
Somebody like a Michael Jackson who was prescribed this and prescribed that, and those two prescriptions Mm-hmm. What a cocktail for murder.
Absolutely.
And so when you're doing that, it's very, very, very important to know what's going in, how long it stays in your body, mm-hmm. the effectiveness of it, because it can stay in your body, but only be effective for so long. You can have something like mm-hmm. A medication that is effective for 6 hours, but stays in your body for 12. Mm-hmm. So you've got to be careful for 12 hours, not 6 hours while it's battling, but for 12 hours, anything you mix with it, depending on what you're mixing. And then the doses, you know, when you say, what's the exit strategy? When you're putting people on painkillers, is it a wonder that we got all these addicts to painkillers going around, going into old folks' homes looking for mm-hmm. pain meds?
It's really, really sad. And something that I'm very proud of, and I want others to really know that you have the ability to push back. You have the ability to say no and ask why. And I called our next meeting and I said, on our next meeting, we're going to both bring in the contraindications of all the drugs that she's on and we'll compare what each of us bring in because you have probably a huge advantage over me. So let's just see what each of us bring in. It was miraculous. Somehow they found out and figured out that all those drugs had gigantic contraindications during the time that they said that there were no contraindications to any of those drugs. Lo and behold, on that next meeting, maybe they didn't want to show up empty-handed. I don't know. But it was crazy. But there's no apologies. There's no, you know, taking responsibility. There's no accountability. And I think that that is the really tough part. And I think that that is only going to continue to get worse when it comes to just people being very ill. And it's the lack of experience now of the nurses that are hired and the lack of salary and a lack of, you know, monetary ability for these nurses to even make a living these days. And so you get less and less that are even able to do the job, let alone care about their job. So I don't want to go down that path too much, but it's certainly something that really shot those red flags up that I knew that I needed to stand up for myself and my daughter and be able to, you know, kind of pull those wild cards out of there and say, I'm not afraid of you. I'm not scared. You know, let's just kind of go toe to toe. And like I said earlier, I'm surprised I wasn't thrown out of the place, but you have to stand up for what you believe in.
Yeah. Yeah. That is absolutely right. And I think it's a good place to end. I mean, you know, if people are listening in, we don't give them everything. Yeah. I mean, you got to have you back here too. This is good. I want to hear more about your journey. One of the things that just stuck out to me too was the key that you took the time to educate yourself. Mm-hmm. And as I'm listening to this, just to kind of summarize, I think that what people need to understand when they're put in these situations is nobody's going to care about you or your family like you will. Yeah. So make sure you take the time and energy to research what's going on. And then don't be afraid to reach out. I think that's the other part. You just don't know where. Well, I got a good podcast for you. Check out Amy Post and her podcast. Read the book, even if you're not going through anything, because this is an inspiring book. You'll go through the gut ache, the heartache. You'll count your blessings.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, you'll also see how God works in the midst of it all, right? I mean, I loved how you started out with, I was at my end, suicidal. And yet you'd gone through all this and it was the weight of all that you were still carrying around, I guess. And you had not released that over to the Lord yet. You were still carrying around all that luggage. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like from the stress of the advocacy to the stress on the marriage, to the stress on life. And you can only, God says, my burden is light. It's not heavy. Mm-hmm. And if you carry around all that, man, it'll bear down and break you. We're not designed for that kind of stress in our lives. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. You just have to really know that it's okay to talk about it, to go through it, to really hash it out. But I mean, pull that rug out from underneath, you know, pull it up and start dealing with some of that stuff. Because one, writing the book was probably one of the most healing things I've ever done in my entire life. And editing it, I had to read it about 60 times. Mm. And I remember reading it the last two times, and it's as if I was reading a book I had never picked up before. It was my new life. It was my new perspective on what I had gone through, but it was also knowing how I was preparing for what is to come, because I don't get to unshoulder this. I don't get to take it off of my doorstep and hand it to someone else, you know? Like a lot of people, you're in a situation for a lifetime, but it's how you perceive it, how you look at it, how you handle it, how you prepare is going to be the number one things that you do. And procrastination has never been in my vocabulary. So I think that's another thing that really helped me through all of this. But you can do it little by little. And I mean, stay tuned. I have a lot of great things to come on the podcast that will kind of go into my coaching that I'm getting ready to start, my second book that I've already started.
Awesome.
But the first book will really give you a good idea of all of this. So yeah, I mean, and you can pre-order it. You can go to my website at amypost.com. Can pre-order it. It's on Amazon, all the major retailers. And then you can find me on Facebook at Advocacy and Hope. And then my podcast is available. We're trying to load as many as we can, but definitely check it out because it's not what you think on some of them. I really dive into some really cool, great topics that maybe you don't expect. So you can find me, you know, under Advocacy and Hope on all the platforms.
Awesome. Awesome. So check it out. Amy Post, Advocacy and Hope. Your book is called, what's the name of the book again?
So it's called Out of the Gray, Into the Light. It's a mother's memoir of advocacy and hope. And that's honestly where the names of the group came from. When I was just writing all of this, I was like, that's perfect.
Awesome. All right. Well, check it out. We appreciate you being here, Amy. And thanks for everybody for listening. Don't forget to like and subscribe a new podcast. Yeah. We got your new one if you're a listener of us. And on top of that, don't forget to help those that sponsor us. Don't forget Annie McCollum at Resource One at 636-458-1798 for all your planning needs. If you're needing a good Christian financial planner or a team, don't forget about Chris with CS Design. Did our intro, outro. If you're a small business needing some website design, some web design, some media stuff, give those guys a call. They've got a great team. 573-436-3717. And lastly, Jeff Earhart, who graciously lets me have Scott every few days. Most of the time he's out today, but you can give those guys a call for any of your State Farm needs for insurance at 314-821-5333. Other than that, we will catch you guys on our next episode. Thanks again. Thanks, Amy.
Thank you.